From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As jury selection continues in the O.J. Simpson civil trial, Johnny Cochran is out promoting his new memoir, Journey to Justice. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Cochran about the strategy that won Simpson's not guilty verdict 1 year ago in the criminal trial. Also today, Andrew Young remembers the bloodiest civil rights demonstration he led and the march he'd most like to forget. He's written a new memoir about the civil rights era called An Easy Burden. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. On the day after the vice presidential debate, Vice President Al Gore is being joined by President Clinton for a joint campaign appearance in Gore's home state of Tennessee. Mr. Clinton is calling for $500 million to be spent to expand internet computer capabilities at 100 universities, national labs, and other federal institutions. He also plans to announce a privately financed project that eventually would connect every American school and library to the internet. Republican challenger Bob Dole applauded his running mate Jack Kemp's performance in last night's debate, saying that Kemp stuck with the ticket's economic plan. Dole and Kemp are also campaigning together today in Ohio. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Bob Dole watched last night's debate at a private home in Illinois and said that the strategy he and his running mate had agreed upon was to keep the focus on the tax cut plan. Although Kemp repeatedly discussed the need to create more wealth through tax cuts, at times he sounded more like a liberal Democrat, saying that the affluent are doing well in this economy, but the poor have been left behind. Kemp dwelled on his favorite topics, such as enterprise zones and the need to revitalize the inner cities, subjects never addressed by Dole as he campaigns. Kemp also strayed on the subject of abortion, saying there is no consensus on the issue and that a constitutional amendment outlawing abortion would not pass. Gore seized the opportunity to point out that a demand for such an amendment is part of the GOP's platform and that Kemp has voted for it 47 times. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Chicago.
Police in Northern Ireland have arrested a man in connection with the IRA's attack on British Army headquarters in Northern Ireland this week. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
Police arrested the man in a dawn raid on a home in Catholic West Belfast. The suspect is being detained under Britain's Prevention of Terrorism Act, which allows the police to question him for up to 7 days before filing charges. The arrest comes less than 24 hours after police released a drawing of a man believed to have purchased the bomber's getaway car at an auction 2 weeks ago. Police also claimed that the IRA had been planning Monday's attack in which two 800-pound car bombs injured 31 people at British Army headquarters for 4 months. That means the attack was conceived before the current round of all-party peace talks, chaired by former U.S. Senator George Mitchell, began. Sinn Féin, the IRA's political wing, is excluded from those talks because of the bombing campaign. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
Time Warner's shareholders have voted to approve a $7.5 billion merger with Turner Broadcasting System. Turner shareholders will vote on the merger later today. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 6.5 points at 5,924 in moderate trading. On the Nasdaq, the composite is up 3.5. This is NPR. Dr. Jack Kevorkian has acknowledged being present this morning at the death of a Texas man who was suffering from multiple sclerosis. Kevorkian drove the body of the man to a Detroit-area hospital. Since 1990, Kevorkian has acknowledged assisting in 42 suicides. More than 6,000 Canadian auto workers have joined a strike against General Motors. The widening of the week-long walkout is expected to cost additional jobs later this week at GM's U.S. operations. The strike now includes all of General Motors' unionized Canadian workers, over 28,000 strong. Negotiators reported no progress on the critical issue of outsourcing. The controversial chief of the U.S. Forest Service says he is resigning. NPR's Philip Davis has more.
Jack Ward Thomas headed the Forest Service for a little under 3 years, but they were contentious years, marked by the bitter debate over the endangered spotted owl. Environmentalists said the owl's decline was an indication of the decline of the old-growth forests of the Pacific Northwest from logging and development. Logging interests said the forests were an economic gold mine that sustained thousands of jobs. Today, the Forest Protection Plan that Thomas, a wildlife biologist, helped engineer is in place, much to the dismay of logging interests. Their allowed take from publicly owned forests has dropped by nearly a quarter. Thomas leaves the government to accept a newly endowed professorship at the University of Montana. He says that politics has nothing to do with his resignation, but that 40 years of government service is enough. No replacement has been named. I'm Philip Davis in Washington.
Aetna Insurance is cutting 4,400 jobs. The Connecticut-based company is also reducing its primary health service centers from 43 to 12. That move results from Aetna's merger with U.S. Healthcare, creating the nation's largest health insurance provider. Nationwide Insurance is curbing sales of new home insurance in coastal areas from Maine to Texas because of heavy natural disaster claims. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Moro, publisher of the new cookbook, Baking with Julia. Savor the joys of baking with America's best bakers, based on the PBS series hosted by Julia Child. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's been 1 year since O.J. Simpson was found not guilty of murder in his criminal trial. But his story continues to unfold. His civil trial is in progress. Journalist Jeffrey Toobin's book about the criminal trial is on the bestseller list. And the main characters from the criminal trial are still weighing in with their versions of the story. Christopher Darden and Robert Shapiro have written memoirs. Marcia Clark's is on the way. My guest Johnny Cochran's memoir has just been published. It's called Journey to Justice. Cochran was the lead attorney on Simpson's defense team. He's the former assistant district attorney of Los Angeles County. He founded his law firm in 1981. His clients include Michael Jackson and Reginald Denny. Jeffrey Toobin's bestseller says that Cochran knew from the start that Simpson was guilty. I asked Cochran to respond.
That's preposterous, and he's absolutely wrong. I know Jeffrey Toobin, having seen him in the courtroom for the year or so we were trying this case, and he's absolutely wrong. Never have I told anybody that I believed O.J. Simpson was guilty or that he should plead guilty to a lesser charge. He makes some allegation. I've not read the book, but the allegation is that supposedly I told somebody this on June 17th. I can tell you that on June 17th, I knew nothing about the case. I didn't see any reports in this case until around July 22nd or thereafter, and I never talked to Mr. Simpson at June 17th. So he's absolutely positively wrong about that, and I guess he did it to sell books.
Would you have defended O.J. Simpson if you had serious doubts about his innocence or if you thought he was actually guilty?
It depends. You know, sometimes you have clients who will come to you and say, I'm guilty. I want you to work out the best deal you can for them. And in that case, you enter into a plea and the case is over with. If you had a client who you believed was guilty or who told you they were guilty, you could defend them, but you certainly could not call witnesses that would fly in the face of what you knew to be the facts or the evidence because he'd be suborning perjury. Of course, we didn't have that problem in the Simpson case because O.J. Simpson always, to everyone on that defense team, has always maintained his innocence, and everything that he told us that we checked out always checked out.
Another thing that Jeffrey Toobin says, he says that O.J. Simpson failed a lie detector test about a week after the murders.
I know nothing about that. As you know, I didn't enter the case in July till July 22nd. This never came up in any of my dealings. It wasn't relevant or whatever. I know nothing about that. I wasn't involved in the case at all at that time, and I don't know if it happened or did not happen.
You've been criticized for making the O.J. Simpson case a case about race, deflecting attention away from Simpson's actual guilt or innocence. And a lot of people say, well, sure, O.J. Simpson was African-American, but in this case, he wasn't a victim of racism as much as he was the beneficiary of celebrity status. What do you say to that?
Oh, people who say that don't really understand the facts. Let me just indicate this to you. First, long before I ever got on the case, race had become a major issue. If you recall, when the case was transferred from Santa Monica, downtown L.A., people raised the issue, well, gee, they're going to have a different racial makeup of the jury. Time magazine took Simpson's photograph and put it on the cover and darkened it significantly. Always the indications of race. But perhaps the telling feature was Mark Furman was called by the prosecution. They knew who he was. They knew he was a virulent racist. But yet then he was a key witness in the case. They put him on the case. as a lawyer involved in the case, I had nothing to do with race from that standpoint. Long before I entered the case, in the July issue of 1994 of New Yorker magazine, Robert Shapiro had told Jeffrey Toobin in that story, the story about the police detective who he believed, the racist police detective who planted the glove. Now, I then come into the case. My role was to deal with credibility of witnesses. Under the case of Davis versus Alaska and other cases, where you have a witness who has racial animus, and he's a key witness in the case, that racial animus, it goes to his bias, where he says he would plant evidence, or he says that if he saw a black man driving down the street with a white woman, he would make up a reason to stop them. It becomes the lawyer's job to pursue the evidence and the credibility of the witness. This witness was not credible, as evidenced by his perjury plea. If I were not to pursue that, or any lawyer were not to pursue that, it would be malpractice, pure and simple. So the rest of this is just fol-de-rol. People who say they don't know what they're talking about. We would have committed malpractice, and you talk to lawyers who try cases, and they'll tell you, we did our job. I didn't raise any issues. I dealt with the issues that are already there.
Is it possible that two things are true at the same time, that Mark Furman is a racist and that he didn't frame O.J. Simpson?
That's possible, but I think a jury would have to make that determination, you see. Mark Furman did some amazing things in this case. He was a man who was off the case, really, but yet insisted on leading the other detectives over there. Remember, he had been taken off the case for Van Atter and Lang, yet he and they knew how to get to Rockingham. So you have this, the specter of these four detectives leaving the scene where these two bodies are out there to go to the Rockingham address to give notice to a person who's no longer not even the next of kin. And you know Van Atter told the Fiato brothers that he just made this up. He went over there because the husband's always the suspect. So they go over there. And then Furman makes all these findings, that the spot on the door, the Bronco, supposedly. He climbs over the wall. He talks to Cato Kalin. He goes by himself while the other detectives are in the house and finds this glove, this still moist glove that everybody agrees would have been dry had it been dropped the night before, some 6 hours later. So, you know, this is, it defies credulity, the set of facts and the circumstances as they evolve.
Let me quote something Christopher Darden wrote in his memoir, and he says, anyone who has truly fought for racial equality in the justice system hated to see those issues manipulated to fit an accused double murderer who had done everything he could to remove himself from the black community and had actually received coddling from the LAPD. They had practically looked the other way while the man beat his wife. And later, Darden writes, Simpson was a black who did not date black women, rarely socialized with blacks, who turned his back on anything black. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think that's more of the hyperbole people write to try to sell books. Christopher Darden was not a friend of O.J. Simpson. He didn't know him. O.J. Simpson has done quite a bit from a standpoint of charities and things. He didn't ask for a lot of credit. Certainly, he dated people other than black people. But I think that's your right in this particular country. I don't think that anybody can say he turned his back on that. He is very, very close to his mother. His children, he knew who he was. Now, he did have some status from a standpoint of what he detained after he left football. But certainly, I don't think he turned his back on that. And those are just easy. You know, see, what you found was everybody was doing this Monday morning quarterbacking. Christopher Darden was trying to explain why he lost the case. And so they come up with these reasoning, this specious reasoning, which doesn't make any sense. You know, I think that it's important to look at this case from a standpoint of this case was decided on the evidence by 12 people who didn't have to listen to the pontificating pundits. They listened and decided the case only on the evidence. And so that's why there was justice done in this case.
There's a forthcoming book by Lawrence Schiller and James Willworth that is going to say that just before the jury was taken to the O.J. Simpson mansion, the defense attorneys did a little bit of redecoration. They replaced pictures of O.J. Simpson's white friends with pictures of black acquaintances. A nude photo of his then-girlfriend Paula Barbieri was removed from Simpson's bedroom, and a framed picture of his mother was put in its place. And this book will also say that you took a poster from your office, a Norman Rockwell portrait of a small African-American girl escorted to school by federal marshals during the Civil Rights era, and that you hung it in the place where jurors couldn't miss it.
No.
True?
I can tell you categorically that I didn't take anything from my office. I did not go to the Rockingham address at any time prior to the tour. I went that Sunday with the jurors. I didn't take anything and put anything in there. With regard to the pictures and things that happened at that house, all we said was to make sure the place looked clean. And to further indicate this is a non-issue, Judge Ito, when we got to the location that Sunday, and I think at both Bundy and at Rockingham, told the jurors, do not look at anything on the walls. In fact, one juror, one male juror, if you look back at the record, who looked at a photograph, looked at something on the wall, was kicked off the jury after that. So it's a non-issue. It didn't mean anything. The jurors were there really to see the walkway where Furman supposedly found this glove. They were there to look and find and just look at the premises, to look at the grounds where all of this took place. So this is really just another non-issue. It has nothing to do with anything. Specifically, there was an order not to look at anything on the walls, and it was irrelevant material.
Are you saying that nobody on the defense team changed any photos or took down any photos in O.J. Simpson's place?
I don't know. I don't think anybody on the defense team did. I don't know. We didn't have any access to the house. The house was, O.J. Simpson had a housekeeper, and the house was maintained by them. And I don't know who did what from standpoint. I'm telling you, I didn't do it. And as I said, it was of no moment, of no consequence at all, because the jurors were told not to pay any attention to that. They were there to look at the grounds, as it were.
And so and no one on the defense team asked anybody to make changes?
No, no, we didn't do that. No, absolutely not.
Johnny Cochran is my guest. He's written a new memoir called Journey to Justice. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Johnny Cochran, he's written a new book called Journey to Justice. In your concluding argument to the jury, you told the jury to send a message. What message did you want the jury to send?
That this jury would not tolerate this kind of sloppy investigation, this kind of rush to judgment, this obsession to win, that in fact this was a case of reasonable doubt, and they had to stop what appeared to be a cover-up, that nobody wanted to get to the facts. And, of course, that's what we meant. And I think jurors, in all cases, send messages. You see, from this standpoint, the jury is the conscience of the community. They set the standards by which we live. They take the facts. They take the law the court gives them. Then they render a decision. In their decision, they send a message that we don't think you proved a case. We think that you rushed the judgment in this case. We think this is a case of reasonable doubt. And that's exactly what the jurists did and said. When they came out, you recall, they said, when they were criticized for not taking longer, they said, how much reasonable doubt did we need? There was ample reasonable doubt. We had no question but to find him not guilty.
Did you think that the jury would take so little time to decide? Did you ever think that?
No, I thought it would take longer. I thought they'd be out much longer than that. And I was surprised. In fact, I was out of town on that date and brushed back, you know, on October 2nd. I got home that evening, and then the verdict, of course, was on October 3rd.
Mark Furman last week pleaded no contest to perjury charges, and that's related to his denial that he ever used the racial epithet. He was sentenced last week to 3 years of probation and a $200 fine. What's your reaction to his sentencing?
No, it's an outrage. I think that, what does that say to us? It says that, you know, all during the trial, you remember, all these pundits were saying, well, gee, a police officer would never lie in a first-degree murder case because, gee, that would be just horrible, send somebody away based upon lying about key factors. Well, we now know that several police officers lied, and one lied to the degree that the prosecution, the Attorney General's office, brought these charges against him, and he went in and entered a no-contest plea, which is tantamount to a guilty plea. So we know that does happen. But the message, I think, is in the sentence is such an outrage in that, you know, what does it say? It says that if you lie, if you're a police officer sworn to tell the truth and protect and to serve, if you lie in a case like this, or in any case for that matter, you get a $200 fine, you get to go home to Idaho and serve your sentence out. And I think that's going to come back to haunt all officers and all people in L.A. County. How do they sentence anybody else to prison on a perjury after this? I mean, I don't think they can. I mean, if you're going to have, unless you have a double standard, it sends a terrible, terrible message. It seems to me it's a wrong sentence.
The judge in the civil trial for O.J. Simpson said the defense would need hard evidence in order to introduce the theory that rogue cops framed Simpson. Do you think that that evidence will end up not being introduced? And if it's not, how do you think it will change? How do you think it will affect the outcome of the verdict?
Well, you know, I think the defense is going to win this case, either win the case or there'll be a hung jury. So it's hard to say. When you talk about introducing hard evidence, is he saying that he wants to have a police informant? That's under the conspiracy of silence or this kind of this blue wall that where police officers just refuse to, you know, talk or look the other way. It's very hard to get witnesses to come forward to testify. I mean, just imagine, this man Furman existed for more than 20 years in the LAPD with all of the nefarious activities he was involved in. You know, no police officer came forward and turned him in. We found these tapes through the screenwriter. So I think it's not realistic to expect that they're going to be able to get people to come forward and say, okay, I did this, I did that, or I was a police officer and I looked the other way. It's very hard. You have to do it very often through circumstantial evidence, through circumstance, you know, one fact leading to another fact. And I trust the judge, when he sees the offer by the defense, will come to realize that and will allow the testimony. This verdict, in order to have some credibility, needs to have a full airing of all the evidence, and it will be unfair to cut off one side or the other, it seems to me.
In your final comments to the jury, in your concluding comments, you said, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit. Who came up with the rhyme?
Jerry Ullman. That was Jerry Ullman's original rhyme. He shared it with me early on, probably in June, July or so, and I liked it and embellished upon it a little bit. And but it was clear, and it occurred maybe a little after June, because it was really tied into the ill-fated glove demonstration by Christopher Darden. And because, you see, they spent so much time saying, okay, these are the killer's gloves, and now, okay, Mr. Simpson, if he's the killer, these gloves will fit him, right? And of course, the gloves hadn't shrunk. They were the exact same size, and the gloves didn't fit. And it just followed that if the gloves didn't fit, the jury would have to acquit.
Now, how'd you feel going with a rhyme in your concluding comments? A lot of people felt, well, this is kind of like coming up with a little rap or a clever slogan or something. And is the concluding comments a place for slogans?
I felt excellent about it. And you're still talking about it. The jurors were still talking about it. You have to graphically demonstrate things so people recall them. You know you've done your job in an argument when, number one, they tell you in law school, if the jurors or a juror starts to cry during your argument, which happened, and number two, when the jurors come out and they quote what you have to say. And to this day, in fact, if you go to the courtroom in Santa Monica, even now in the civil case, those people who believe that Mr. Simpson is innocent, there's a recent article in the LA Times, are still articulating the argument that we gave. And the people who believe he's innocent can better articulate, according to this article, the reasons why he's innocent than people who say they believe he's guilty.
Johnny Cochran is my guest, and he's written a new book called Journey to Justice. You write in the book, and I think a lot of people agree with this, that picking the jury was probably the most important thing that you did. What were your standards in picking the jury? What techniques did you use that you can look back and say, this was really effective?
Well, I think, again, the techniques I've used for 33 or 34 years, you know, the book is really an autobiography. You know, it's not just about Simpson. As you're probably aware, we don't talk about Simpson until chapter 10, some 225 pages into the book. So I do what I always did. I use my visceral reaction. I use the feeling I have about dealing with people. But I had something else in this case. I had Dr. Joellen Demetrius, who's our jury consultant, who's absolutely magnificent. And we had an idea of the kinds of jurors we're looking at, primarily probably women, middle-aged women we thought were good. If they happen to be African-American, fine. If not, we still wanted primarily women in this case. We thought that would be the best kind of jurors for us in this case.
Let me stop you here. Some people would have thought women would be the worst kind of jurors for the defense because they would empathize with Nicole Simpson and see O.J. Simpson as a wife beater and have very little sympathy for him. So why did you think that women would be very strong for the defense?
Because I understood what the facts were, and the people still don't understand it. In this case, and nothing should ever obscure the fact that all of us, and I think on the defense, feel very strongly about there should be no domestic violence in society. In fact, as the assistant district attorney for L.A. County in 1978 and 79, I established the Domestic Violence Council for L.A. County, which is now a role model for the entire nation. So we felt very strongly about it. I went out and I got the best witness in the country that I could find, Dr. Lenore Walker in Denver, Colorado, on this issue. We knew there was this one battering incident which is not to be justified, but he did enter a plea for that and paid his debt to that. There was no other violence after that, no other physical violence. And the indication from the experts was they'd have to be some kind of increasing lethality, where this violence goes on and it gets worse and it escalates into some kind of homicide. We had none of that at all in this case. So they made a mistake. I mean, their theory was just out and out wrong, and the juror said that. I remember juror number 7 coming and said, this was not a domestic violence case. Where was the trigger? Where was the fuse? Remember, that's what we talked about. They made this, you know, what they talked about was theory. So I knew that these jurors, middle-aged jurors who are sophisticated, would be able to see through that. That was what their theory was, but they could never hook it up. And as it turns out, the jurors that we thought we should get was right. And Marcia Clark was told by Don Vinson, their expert at Decision Quest, that they should not get the jury. So we end up looking at the same kind of juror. We got these women, middle-aged women, many of whom were African-Americans. We wanted, Marcia Clark thought she wanted, contrary to the advice of her expert, and therein was a mistake, it seems.
Joellen Demetrius, who was your jury consultant, ran focus groups for the defense throughout the trial. What are some of the most important things you learned during the focus group? And I'm particularly wondering if there was something you thought of trying that you decided not to because it played badly in the focus groups.
Yes, there probably was. I thought that I always have believed that Rosa Lopez told the truth, that Rosa Lopez was a credible witness with regard to the fact that Bronco was out there, you know, outside of her house when she took a dog for a walk after about 10:15 on June 12th in the evening hours. But because she was cross-examined vigorously by Mr. Darden and by the prosecution, because there was, she said on many occasions, no me recuerdo, I don't remember or whatever, and there was a problem with the interpreters and everything, the focus group jurors did not find her to be all that credible. And it just seemed to us that we made a judgment. We didn't want to expose her or expose our case to that. Wherever we had a witness, what we had a problem with, even though I may have said I'm going to use them in an opening statement, we made a judgment not to do that in the trial. Marianne Gertjes was another witness who saw the people running away from the scene. She got a felony conviction after that, the prosecution prosecutor. Well, we had a problem. Unlike what they did with Furman, we didn't put those witnesses up there. And I think a lawyer, you have a responsibility to do that. And so we tried to put witnesses up who we could, if not personally vouch for, you can't do that, but at least we felt would be more credible. The prosecution didn't do this, and they paid a real price for that.
Tell me how else you used the focus groups.
Oh, it was very helpful. Well, for instance, we wanted to know at the time of argument which lawyers did the jurors like. And the lawyers were all rated. In the book, we talk about that. Who was rated first, who was rated second, who was rated, who was with about. All of us as defense lawyers.
And you got top score, I should add.
Well, you know, modestly, he says, right, yeah, we did. And Barry Sheck and Peter Neufeld were second. But it was more important than the top score that I got was the fact that the prosecution was way down. I mean, they were not found particularly credible or believable, and we thought that was going to be important. It also helped me to know that I'd picked the right person, having Barry Sheck do the second argument with me.
Johnny Cochran, his new memoir is called Journey to Justice. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Johnny Cochran. Also, Andrew Young remembers the civil rights march he'd most like to forget. The former mayor of Atlanta has written a memoir about the civil rights movement. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Johnny Cochran. He's just written a memoir called Journey to Justice. Cochran was the lead defense attorney on O.J. Simpson's criminal trial. Robert Shapiro wanted you to be the lawyer that cross-examined Mark Furman.
That's correct.
Right, and he thought it would be just particularly dramatic to have an African-American lawyer cross-examining this white racist cop.
Right.
And you decided, no, you weren't going to do it. You were going to have Effley Bailey cross-examine Furman. Well, why didn't you want to do it yourself? Why go with Bailey instead?
Okay. In the book, you'll remember that I had spent much of my career in handling these police abuse cases. Our firm had won over $45 million in damages against cities and counties in the state of California in the decade of the 80s. So this is something I did and was pretty expert at. Credibility of police officers. But because I didn't want to enhance this whole issue of race, the picture of the black lawyer cross-examining vigorously this white police officer, something I didn't want to have that image there. And I felt that here was a person we knew was lying. And so I, despite Shapiro's protestations, said, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to have Bailey do it. And I think I made the right decision. It seemed to lower the tensions, et cetera, and I think it was appropriate, and I would do the same thing again.
Did you advise O.J. Simpson after the trial about talking to the press? For instance, he was on the phone with Larry King shortly after the trial. He made the video. Did he ask you about any of that?
No, he didn't ask me at first. In fact, I was on that program. I was on Larry King's program when he called in. I was very surprised. But he did what he talked to us about, and I don't know if he asked me, but I told him he was going to be interviewed by Katie Couric, I believe, and maybe Tom Brokaw with NBC shortly after the trial. And we unanimously, all the lawyers came together and said, you know, this is wrong. You shouldn't do this at this point. You're going to have a civil case. You shouldn't do this under these things. And so he listened to us and opted not to.
And the obviously the show was canceled.
That show was canceled.
That was big news.
Mm-hmm.
Are you in touch with O.J. Simpson now?
Yes, I talk to him. I talk to him fairly regularly. I talk to the lawyers, so I know, fairly well what's going on in the civil case.
How do you think he will do if he testifies at the civil case?
I think he'll be a very good witness. I mean, you should understand that the reason why O.J. Simpson didn't testify had nothing to do with any fear we had as a witness. I think you're going to find he's going to be one of the best witnesses in the entire trial. We didn't have him testify because we had at least one juror who said, if this case isn't over in September, I'm leaving. We're going to lose jurors. We did not want a mistrial. By this time, after the glove demonstration and the Fiato brothers and all the things that had happened, we thought we were winning the case. Our focus groups told us we were winning the case. So we had to get this case over. So we made another decision that Mr. Simpson, of course, concurred in, that he shouldn't testify. He didn't have to testify. So I think you're going to find he's a very good witness, a very credible witness. People are going to be, some people will be very, very surprised. I think that's going to be a major component in it. I think he'll be a very important part of the case.
You've said that you think that the civil trial will also give a not guilty verdict to Simpson.
Well, he'll be found not liable, right, I believe, or he'll be a hung jury, one of the two.
Right. Now, if the decision is guilty.
Well, it won't be guilty, but if he's found liable, right?
Liable,
for
thank you. Yeah,
right.
So if the decision is that he's liable, what are we to make of contradictory verdicts? Or is there no contradiction when a civil trial and a criminal trial come up with different verdicts?
Well, that's an interesting question. There's a different burden of proof. In the civil case, as you know, it's by preponderance of the evidence. So the evidence preponderates a little bit more on one side or the other. 51% to 49? Okay, that's preponderance of the evidence. So technically it could happen, but, how do you have a case that the theory of the prosecution was that this was a willful killing? So either you have that or you don't. The first jury found that you didn't have that based upon beyond a reasonable doubt until moral certainty. This jury is being asked to say, well, it's almost like negligence or that this was maybe not even an unintentional killing. So how do you have that on these facts? It can be very difficult, it seems to me, to have that. But it's an anomaly. It's not double jeopardy, as it were, but it is a real anomaly in the law.
Robert Shapiro has said that he wouldn't work with you again and that you haven't spoken to each other since the trial. Do you feel the same way about working with him again?
Well, yeah, I don't think we'll be working together. He's not, he's not really a trial lawyer, so I don't think we'll be seeing each other anyway. But, I don't bear him any ill will. I thought he did a very good job in putting together the team. The problem with Robert Shapiro was that he didn't know where to stand. He was on these shifting sands. As an advocate, and I talk about this in the book, you don't run over and try to befriend the police or wear a ribbon in your lapel the day you're cross-examining Van Adder, supporting the police. You get attacked by the police, which he did, and your own teammates. You don't run over and become good friends with Turtelo, who's representing Furman. And then what happens? He gets sued for $50 million by Furman. And it was only because we found those tapes that was kicked out. You don't tape record conversations with members of your team surreptitiously. You know, you got to stand for something.
Back up. Recorded conversations surreptitiously with members of the team.
In the book, we talk about it. I saw his tape recorder going in the lockup in a conversation, me and O.J. Simpson and others, in the lockup. We talk about this in the book. You don't do those kinds of things. You don't sneak out on the day that the verdict is coming in and have an interview with Barbara Walters, blasting your team members, never telling us because you believe that you've been found, that the defendant has been found guilty. You don't call up Alan Dershowitz and said the night of October 2nd, prepare the appeal. You don't do any of those things and call yourself a lawyer or somebody who's going to be true to the client to the end. Those are my problems with Robert. Other than that, you know, he's all right.
One of the statements he made about you after the trial was that you dealt the race card from the bottom of the deck.
Yes, he did say that. And again, that's as incredible as everything else I mentioned earlier, that Bob Shapiro, the one thing, Jeffrey Toobin has a lot of things wrong in his book, but the one thing he's not wrong about it because it's in black and white, he conducted an interview with Bob Shapiro before I was ever on the case. Bob Shapiro was very proud of the fact that he came up with this theory that this racist police officer had planted the glove. That was his theory. You notice when Furman got around to suing people for $50 million, he didn't sue any of us because we didn't say it. It was Shapiro. So as Toobin, as Furman. And so for him then to accuse us of that was, again, I mean, it was a desperate act of contrition. And you know, and it's very, very unfortunate. So in this case throughout, you see these things where lawyers don't act like lawyers. They violate their oath to their clients. It's pretty shocking, but it keeps happening over and over again.
Which of the O.J. Simpson books have you read so far?
None. I've been busy, and I was writing my own. I haven't read any of them.
Well, didn't you want to say, what are the charges people are making against all the other lawyers? What are people saying about me that I might want to refute, if not in the book, at least on the interview tour?
No, because I didn't have to, because whenever I'm interviewed like this, I always get all the charges. Believe me, I hear them as soon as they're made. I hear them, and I didn't have to buy their books to read them or hear them. And I've just tried to take one of the reasons we did the book was to try to set the record straight on the many fabrications that had gone forward. And, of course, there's some still coming out. So the ones that you're hearing now about Toobin and or the Schiller book or anything, I just have to deal with it as it comes up.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure. You've been very, very knowledgeable on the issues, and I hope I've responded to your questions.
Johnny Cochran's new memoir is called Journey to Justice. Coming up, Andrew Young remembers the bloodiest civil rights march he ever led. This is Fresh Air. Before he became a congressman and the mayor of Atlanta, Andrew Young was one of the leaders of the civil rights movement. He worked with Martin Luther King from 1961 until King's death in 1968. In fact, Young was with King the night he was assassinated. Young moved to Atlanta in 1961 to join the senior staff of King's group, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Young eventually became the executive director. His new memoir, An Easy Burden, offers a behind-the-scenes look at the civil rights movement and describes what it was like to lead thousands of people on dangerous marches. The bloodiest march he led was in St. Augustine, Florida. The march was organized by Hosea Williams. Young was certain the march would be dangerous and thought it was unnecessary because Congress was on the verge of passing the Civil Rights Act. He couldn't see risking people's lives, so Young went to St. Augustine with the intention of stopping the march.
But when I got down there that night, as I came through town, I realized that there was a big Klan rally going on. And there must have been 400 or 500 Klansmen in the town square. Well, when I came into the church, Jose announced, here's the Reverend Andrew Young. He's come down from Atlanta to lead the demonstration. And I had no intention of leading any demonstration. But he had a group of volunteers who had decided that they were going to demonstrate. Now, they didn't know that the Klan was down there. They had traditionally, on a couple of nights before, it was at night, incidentally, they had walked down to the old slave market, stopped to have a prayer against the continued modern slavery of segregation, and walked back to the church. It seemed simple enough, except that I realized that we were going to have to walk through a Klan mob.
So do you try to talk to the Klan leader to reason with him?
What happened when we started out there, I had to lead the march because I couldn't just discourage the young people. So I led the march and decided that I better go and, take control of it. But when we got to where the Klan was, I held the crowd back. I held the march back, and I walked forward to try to talk to them, to explain to them what we were trying to do.
To explain to the Klan.
To the Klan. And while I was talking to the leader, somebody hit me from behind with a stick, a blackjack or something, but I was literally knocked unconscious, and I saw later, I didn't realize at the time, I was kicked and beaten and stomped for a good little while there.
The way you saw that is that there was a network TV camera that filmed it, and you were
there was
able
a
to
network TV
footage.
Camera, and I didn't see it till several months later.
It must have been pretty interesting to watch yourself while unconscious getting beaten by members of the Klan.
Well, it was, and because when they finished beating me, and Willie Bolden, who was our staff member with me, picked me up. I went back to the front of the line, and I said, we can't turn around. And we walked on forward again. And this time, the crowd followed me. And we had another confrontation with a Klan, and a guy tried to kick me and hit me again. This time, I saw him and kind of ducked out of the way. And I think the fact that we did stand our ground and sat there nonviolently singing and praying, we finally worked our way on through the mob and back to the church. But then it was a case of people who had their first taste of freedom. These were people who had been intimidated by the Klan. They'd been intimidated by the sheriff. And they'd never stood up to racial segregation before. And there were about 50, mostly women and children, who suddenly felt like they were free. And you couldn't run out on them. You had to nurse that freedom along. So we had to keep on demonstrating. And during the days that followed, a lot of people were beaten. We ended up with more people going to the hospital and more people hurt than in any other movement. I was not one of them. I guess I got a hard head and nothing broke. But a number of people were seriously beaten, and they were determined, though. It seemed like the more they were beaten, the more they came. And finally, I said to the men, I said, look, the Klan is beating women and children, and you guys say you can't be nonviolent, but you're not being violent either. You've been intimidated by these guys, and I challenged them. I said, if we can get 25 men to march with us at any time, I guarantee you the Klan will not touch a soul.
But let me get this straight. In other words, only women and children were participating, and the men were saying, we don't really want to.
They were
march.
Saying, we don't believe in nonviolence. If somebody right. hits me, I'm a. And so I said that was meaningless bravado. And here they hadn't done anything all their lives about segregation. If they weren't nonviolent, why weren't they at least violent? They were passive.
They weren't doing anything.
They weren't doing anything. And when we challenged the men to take part, the times that we had at least 25 men in a march, it was amazing. The Klan never touched a soul.
That's really interesting. I wonder why.
Well, they were afraid of black men.
Uh-huh.
And it was easy. I mean, they were cowards as well. I mean, the Klan was not.
Cowards. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was easy to try to intimidate women and children and one or two men.
There was a time that you went to jail with a lot of young people almost as their chaperone. What happened was, the way you describe it, that this was a march in Savannah, Georgia, and a lot of the young people weren't trained in the ways of civil disobedience. So they weren't, like, disciplined
yeah.
demonstrators. And there were mass arrests. They were going to jail. There were no adults with them. And you were really worried about what was going to happen. So you basically asked to be arrested.
Yeah, well, the Savannah police thought that they could stop the movement by arresting all the leaders. So they arrested all the leaders on something called a peace warrant. Well, the kids wouldn't quit. So you had, when I arrived in Savannah, it was the same sort of thing. A march was underway. They were leaving the church as I arrived, and they had not been arrested, but they were going downtown to the Holiday Inn to have a demonstration and thought they were going to come right back. Well, I just followed them along to see what happened. And when they got to the Holiday Inn, they were all arrested. And I knew that these kids were not prepared to go to jail. Nope, there hadn't been any training because all the leaders were in jail. So I went to the policeman. I said, if you're going to arrest these kids, you better take me with them. And so he put me in the paddy wagon with them.
And what'd you do that was helpful in jail?
Well, I stopped a prison riot the first night.
Good.
Because they deliberately, when it was mealtime, they served them grits, which were coal, and they poured hot grease on it. And the kids, well, Savannah is one of the places where there's a lot of seafood. People are used to eating pretty good. And the kids, somebody took the whole plate of grits and threw it back at the prison guard, and before long, everybody was throwing grits all over the place. And I had to kind of quiet them down, explain to them that you didn't do that. And we talked about jail discipline, and we went back to the room where everybody was sleeping, and we had prayers, and we had discussions, and we sang songs, and we made jail was supposed to be a workshop. And whenever we organized jail-ins, there were people trained to lead workshops. They took their Bibles with them. They took their toothbrushes. They had Gandhi's principles of nonviolent resistance, which they discussed every day. Jail was the best thing that had ever happened to a lot of these kids. There was another kind of thing. When they took us to the court the next day, it was the middle of the summer in Savannah. It was about 100 degrees out there. They put us in the paddy wagon and drove us into town, and they left us in the sun. And the kids started panicking, and when we knocked on the window and said that it was hot in there, let us out, the policeman closed the windows. And so it was like being in an oven. And they started panicking. And I said, you know, this is a test. They're trying to break your spirit. And this is a time when you've got to learn that mind can overcome matter. And I quieted them down and I said, I want you to sing with me. And we started singing Wade in the Water. Wade in the water, children. God's going to trouble the water. And I asked them to hum it. And while they were humming Wade in the Water, I started talking to them about being on a beach and about how hot it was on the beach and how they were sweating just like they were sweating now. I said, but we're going to hold hands, and in your mind, we're going to walk down and we're going to wade in this water. And we, in our minds, went to the beach, walked in the water, and people calmed down and cooled off. And the next thing you know, instead of kids panicking, they were laughing, they were doing their own fantasizing. And even though it was probably 110, 120 degrees in that paddy wagon, there was no panic. And once the police realized that we were in control of the situation, we weren't going to panic, they let us out.
If you're just joining us, Andrew Young is my guest, and he's written a new memoir about the civil rights movement called An Easy Burden. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Andrew Young, former congressman, former mayor of Atlanta, former civil rights activist, and now author of a new civil rights memoir called An Easy Burden. Marching in the South, you were exposed to all kind of evils and dangers, Klan beatings, police dogs, fire hoses turned on you, police beatings. But you say the march you'd most like to forget was actually in the North, in Chicago's Gage Park, on August 5th of 1966. Why was that the one you'd most like to forget?
Well, in the first place, we thought Chicago was the promised land. We thought up north we wouldn't face this kind of racism. We expected the Klan, but St. Augustine was probably 30, 40,000 people, and there were 400 Klansmen who had come from all over Florida, all over North Florida. They had two-way radios, and so we knew this was a kind of a rabble. These were not the good people of the South. And we felt that if we stood up to the riffraff in a nonviolent way, it would literally force the good-thinking people of the South, the truly religious people, to take some new leadership and change the situation. And that had happened in the South. That happened over and over again. In Birmingham, when the mob and the police got out of hand, we formed a committee of 100 businessmen, and they came in and they made changes. They negotiated the desegregation of Birmingham, even though it was against the law, to have integrated lunch counters. If 100 businessmen agreed to integrate lunch counters got integrated. But when we went to Gage Park, these were middle-class white people who the whole community was out there against us. We must have had 10,000 people out there jeering and throwing bricks and firecrackers and shouting death threats. And it was frightening to me because I didn't expect to see, I mean, the equation that I had worked out for the South, that these were just the people who didn't know any better, and if you stand up to the people who don't know any better, the more enlightened people and intelligent people and decent people in the community would stand up and change. But these were the decent people who were the mob, and that was frightening to me. I had a little rented car that... we parked by in the park, and they took it and set it on fire and pushed it in the lake. I was marching with Martin Luther King, and he asked me to go, you know, see about something in the back of the line. And I asked another fellow to stand right in front of him because we didn't want him to be totally exposed. And as soon as I put the other fellow in front of Martin and turned around to go to the back of the line, a brick or something came through and bashed in the front of his head. It was savage and it was frightening because it was blocks and blocks and blocks of people on tree-lined streets in nice homes who supposedly were good church people who had a reasonable education, and they were acting like maniacs.
In your years when you were in politics after the Civil Rights Movement, when you served in Congress and then served as the mayor of Atlanta, did you miss the sense of righteousness and solidarity of the Civil Rights Movement?
I missed the camaraderie. But I had it in Congress. You know, I found some of the finest men and women I have ever known in the Congress of the United States. There's a sense in which Patricia Schroeder and Barbara Jordan, Yvonne Braithwaite Burke, Liz Holtzman, Ron Dellums, all of us went to Congress together. We stopped the war in Vietnam. We were like a movement within the Congress. John Conyers, Morris Udall. There was a sense that the world could be changed within the government when I went to Congress because we were changing things.
Andrew Young, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Andrew Young's new memoir about the civil rights movement is called An Easy Burden. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Naomi Person, with Louisa Shafia and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Alan, too, directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Crown Publishing Group, publisher of The Genesis of Ethics, How the Dysfunctional Family of Genesis Leads Us to Moral Development, by theologian Burton L. Vysotsky. This is NPR, National Public Radio.